Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin this hour, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Anybody can call. Lines have stayed quite full, and so we have worked our way through the questions pretty quickly, and we will probably continue to do that. As lines open up, you're just welcome to call and get in that line, 888-318-7884. If the video looks good to you, that's Johnny Versillo. That's our new intern running the video machine in there. Doing a good job, Johnny. Thank you very much for the work and for coming in. As I said, Jimmy Akin, our guest, and let me count them up, 1 million people on the line. So back to the phones we go. Aaron's in Hastings, Michigan, watching on YouTube. Welcome back, Aaron. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call. And thanks, guys. I actually gave your call screen of the wrong verse. It was Judith 15:9-10.
Okay.
To me, it sounds like Israel's worshiping her as a Judith as a goddess. And I know that's not right, because...
Okay, well, so Judith 15:9-10, so it's going to be talking about Judith, the heroine who helped save Israel in the book of Judith. And it says, "And when they met her, they all blessed her with one accord and said to her, 'You are the exaltation of Jerusalem. You are the great glory of Israel. You are the great pride of our nation. You have done all this single-handed. You have done great good to Israel, and God is pleased with you. May the Lord Almighty bless you forever.' And all the people said, 'So be it.'" Okay?
Yep.
Well, it doesn't sound to me like they're worshiping her as a deity there. In fact, they acknowledge she's inferior to a deity because it says God is pleased with you. So what they're doing is they're celebrating all the stuff that Judith is portrayed as doing in the book of Judith, where she rescues Israel from a general that's been sent by Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Assyrians, according to the very beginning of the book, which is a signal, by the way, because everybody knew in the ancient world that Nebuchadnezzar was king of the Babylonians, not the Assyrians. So this is a fusion of Israel's two great enemies, the Babylonians and the Assyrians. This would be to us, and Judah's name also means Lady Jew. So to us, this would be like reading a book that is about Miss America who defeats a general sent by Adolf Hitler, king of the Russians. You know, so it's clear we're reading a symbolic story here, like an extended parable rather than an actual historical account. But even taking that into consideration, they're not worshiping her as a deity here. You have to interpret examples of praise in their context. And here they acknowledge that Judith is inferior to God and that he's pleased with her because of what she's done. And you find the same thing if you continue on. If you look in the next chapter, there is a passage where Judith herself begins to sing, and she says, "Begin a song to my God with tambourines, sing to the Lord with cymbals." And then a little bit further on in 16:6, she says, "The Lord Almighty has foiled them by the hand of a woman." So she sees God as working through her actions, and God is the one who ultimately gets credit. And given that this was a culture that was very opposed to idolatry and worshiping people, much less women, as deities, all of it hangs together from a common sense point of view. That doesn't mean they don't use poetry that is, you know, very flattering to her, but I don't think that the author meant us to understand that they were literally worshiping her as a god.
Aaron, makes
okay.
sense. Go ahead.
Yeah, I knew I was misinterpreting that, so...
Mm-hmm. Well,
I just knew it because it's like scripture cannot contradict itself. I know that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you called. It's always nice to talk with you. Thank you. On we go, only because all the lines are full. Chris is in North Carolina, listening on Catholic.com. Chris, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you very much. Jimmy, I don't understand your article on abortion, Daily mm-hmm. Defense number 70, where you say abortion is not a religious issue. Mm-hmm. The condemnation of abortion is a infallible doctrine of the Catholic Church. Abortion is a violation of the fifth commandment, thou shalt not murder. Unborn babies are created in the image and likeness of God. The babies cry out to God for vengeance, and the perpetrator is cursed by God. And whoever attacks human life in some way attacks God. Those are all very religious issues pertaining to abortion.
Okay, so in order to understand the approach I'm taking, one needs to understand the context socially of this claim. The idea, so after Roe v. Wade was issued by the Supreme Court in 1973, a movement. It was principally the Catholic Church that opposed abortion here in America. It took a while, but our evangelical friends eventually came on board with the realization that, oh yeah, these are human beings. We can't just kill them. They were actually shaky on that in the early days after Roe v. Wade. You had some very famous Protestants who thought, well, this is not necessarily the best decision, but you know, but you could abort kids in some circumstance. And as they reflected on the matter, because Catholics were vociferous in saying this just cannot be, they realized Catholics were right, and they joined the pro-life movement in large numbers. Well, what that had the effect of doing was it allowed abortion advocates to have an argument where they would say, oh, look at all these Catholics and Protestants who are opposed to abortion. This is a religious issue. And that was used as what's sometimes called a squelch. A squelch is something you say to just shut down discussion of an issue, because the idea is this is a religious issue. We all have different religions here in America, and therefore we shouldn't impose our religions on other people. And so this is just a religious issue. Shut up about opposing abortion. And it was used to squelch pro-life speech. So it's important that pro-lifers resist that squelch. And one of the ways that this is done is to point out that, no, this doesn't have to be a religious issue. It may have religious aspects, as you, Chris, have pointed out. You know, the faith is going to have something to say about abortion. And in fact, the Christian faith since the first century has said that abortion is dead wrong. In fact, you shall not murder a child by abortion is found in a first century Christian document known as the Didache. So Christianity has been opposed to abortion all the way through its history, and it does have religious aspects, but it is not just a religious issue. You don't have to be religious in order to realize that abortion is wrong. All you have to do is realize that the unborn are human beings, which is just a scientific truth, and you have to realize that killing innocent human beings is wrong. And you don't have to be religious to recognize either one of those facts. And so, in fact, there are non-believers, whether they're atheist or agnostic, who are also pro-life. So what the statement that this is not a religious issue is meant to do is meant to communicate this is not just a religious issue. You don't have to be religious in order to recognize the wrongness of abortion. And that takes away the squelch that is used to try to silence pro-life speech. And it puts pro-life advocates in a position of greater advantage to be persuasive in helping other people realize the horror of abortion.
Chris, thank you. That brings us to the break. I appreciate the question. I also appreciate the word squelch. That's a good one. That can help to make a point. I appreciate that. Chris, thanks. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live. Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
At EWTN Radio, your family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And lots of folks on the line, but hey, a line is open right now. Perfect time to call if you've got a question for Jimmy. And anybody's welcome, 888-318-7884. Dial that number and we'll get you on as quick as we can. With Jimmy, we're going out to Art in Redding, California, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Art, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Well, hello, everybody. My question, I'm looking to see if there's any teaching or maybe what the opinions are about when we die, whether we're in purgatory, heaven, or hell. How old will we be?
How physically old will we be? Because we're going to be as old as however many years it's been since we were conceived. But in heaven, hell, and purgatory, in the intermediate state before resurrection, we're not going to have bodies. So we won't have a physical age until the resurrection. Now, when we get to the resurrection, the church doesn't have a teaching on how physically old we'll be. But there is speculation on this subject. One of the proposals is that we will suffer neither the defects of body that come with immaturity nor the defects of body that come with old age. So we won't be either physically immature or physically, I hate to use the word decrepit, but decrepit. And so instead, we'll be in the prime of life, according to this proposal. And a common sub-proposal is that we would be about 33 years old in terms of physical age. And that's because Jesus was about 33 years old when he was crucified. So some people have thought, okay, well, that's an appropriate number. Really, though, if this I'd be less certain of that than we would be, you know, in the prime of life, you know, not having either the limitations of youth or old age. However, I suspect that the truth may be something else, that we may have even fewer limits. We may not just lack the limits of youth and lack the limits of old age. We may lack the limits of having a single physical age. One of the things that we see in various apparitions is Jesus doesn't always appear at the same age. You know, sometimes he appears as an adult, but sometimes he appears as the infant of Prague. And we're told we're going to be like Jesus. Well, okay, Jesus could physically alter his age. And there's even a passage, now this is in a Gnostic gospel, so it's not canonical and it's not reliable, but there's even a fascinating passage where you got a couple of the disciples who are rowing on the Sea of Galilee to get up to Jesus, who's on the shore, and one of them sees him as a young man who has a short beard, and the other sees him as an old man with a long flowing beard. And so even though this is, I just mentioned this for fun because it's not a serious historical document, it does reflect an awareness that Jesus is not confined by the limits of age. And we actually see the same thing in reports of ghost encounters, where According to, ghost encounters that have been studied closely by parapsychologists, it appears that ghosts, now take this for what it's worth, but it appears that ghosts can be can appear as the age they choose to appear as. Usually in what are known as spontaneous after-death communications, which I did a couple of episodes of Mysterious World on, when people see their departed relatives, they see them younger than they were when they died. And it may not be a lot younger because they still want to be recognizable, but they are younger. And sometimes they're dramatically younger. Sometimes a person will appear as a child, even though they were an old person when they died. So that if that flexibility of appearance carries over to our physical bodies in the resurrection, then we wouldn't necessarily be confined to any one particular age physically. We could choose the age we wish to appear as. I suspect by virtue of his divine power, Jesus is able to do that with his physical body. And if we're going to be like Jesus, then we ought to be able to do the same thing.
And I will leave that there because lots of folks on the line. I hope that was helpful to you, Art. Let's go to Brennan in Lansing, Michigan, also listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Brennan, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thank you. On the discussion of hell, I read a chapter in a book. I wish I could tell you the exact book. I think it was called The Kingdom of God, Chapter 4, but it was a scholarly book given to me by a priest, but it talked about how hell depends on the immortality of the soul, and that's one of the logic problems if you wanted to get rid of hell, but that the immortality of the soul was not well supported in Scripture, and that St. Augustine is the one that really kind of promulgated that. And so I was just wondering if you knew anything of this type of discussion. But then one other thing is my own personal thought about it was they point to the part in Scripture where it says, and the fire shall not be quenched, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't say the fuel shall not be consumed. And so I felt like that was kind of a weak logical argument to pin a lot on that phrase.
All right.
Verse.
Let's let Jimmy take
a stab. Okay, so Brennan, I need to ask a follow-up question. When you referred to the immortality of the soul, that gets understood in different ways in different groups. It can refer to the idea that the soul survives death and continues indefinitely, forever. In other words, that the soul is everlasting. But in other contexts, it means the soul doesn't survive death at all, which version of the immortality of the soul. So some people will say, for example, the soul dies. This is a view called Christian mortalism. They would say the soul dies at death and then God later resurrects you, but there's no intermediate state between death and resurrection that you have conscious experiences of.
I'm thinking of the continuous existence of the soul. And so that's what I had in mind. That's what I thought the logic problem was. I'll tell you when this started. When I was a kid, a very young child, contemplating hell, I discovered that the most terrifying thing to me, that I tried to imagine suffering forever, but the most terrifying thing for me was that for my existence to be blotted out. Not that I wouldn't exist, for existence to be blotted out, philosophically, to me, means not that you ceased to exist into the future, but that you never existed at all. And my feeling is that's the most terrifying thing. And I think that
Brennan, we're getting close to the break, so I need to try to give you the best answer I can. First, so I understand the idea of being deleted from history so that you never existed, that would be terrifying. And that is something that happens in various science fiction scenarios, but that is not the understanding of the Christian church. That's not the teaching of any branch of Christianity I'm aware of. There are some branches of Christianity that are annihilationist, as I mentioned in a previous call, that say the damned will cease to exist, but nobody says the damned are going to be deleted from history so that they never existed. In terms of this book, now I would say I'm gonna talk about both forms of the immortality of the soul, because it wasn't clear to me which this book is advocating, and I don't know the book, I don't know who wrote it. In regard to the idea that the soul is not everlasting, you know, you mentioned the particular passage in Revelation that talks about the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. And they had this quip about, but it doesn't say the fuel's not going to run out. Well, okay, the passage doesn't even mention any fuel. The book of Revelation depicts the lake of fire as a lake that is composed of fire, but there's no fuel running the fire. And secondly, it doesn't just say that the smoke goes up forever and ever. It says that, and they have no rest day or night. So that is indeed a weak counter argument here. In terms of the, there's also a problem with the idea that the soul would continue, that the soul is not immortal when it's raised. There are actually several problems. One of them is that, and I'll just go for the big one. Christ has promised eternal life, and so souls will go on forever and ever, certainly for the saved. But the scripture also refers not just to the saved have an everlasting life, it refers to the lost have an everlasting shame. And that would mean their souls also go on forever and ever. Now let's talk about the idea of the soul just not surviving death, because this is a popular view, or has been a popular view, in some scholarly circles in the mid-20th century. The idea was that until fairly late in their history, the Jewish people did not have a clear understanding of the afterlife, and they thought you basically ceased to exist. Well, okay, the Sadducees, one of the groups in First Temple Judaism, in Second Temple Judaism, thought that. But that's a minority position even within Judaism. The idea that Jews in general did not believe in an afterlife is complete and utter hogwash. To cite one example, the Old Testament forbids Israelites from going to a medium to contact the dead. Well, you don't forbid people from doing things they have no desire to do. So this shows that Israelites did have a desire to make contact with their departed loved ones by using mediums. Also, everybody else in all the surrounding cultures believed in an afterlife. And so it's natural the Israelites would too. Then there is the fact that we have archaeological evidence of Israelite burial customs. And one of the things we find is they buried grave goods with their loved ones. Grave goods are things that are meant, at least symbolically, for the departed person to use during their afterlife. So like you might bury a child with a favorite toy, or you might bury your wife with some of her favorite jewelry, or you might bury a man with his knife and his spear, or things like that. And we find grave goods in ancient Israelite graves. We also find food offerings to them that suggest after their death, their relatives were leaving food for them to use in the afterlife. So we've got a bunch of evidence for belief in the soul surviving death in Israelite culture all the way back. In the New Testament, it's also clear that the soul survives death. Among other places, we have Jesus telling the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, where the souls of both Lazarus and the rich man survive death. And you can say that's a parable, but Jesus's parables are filled with things from real life, like farmers and sons and kings and so forth. Then you've got St. Paul saying we, meaning himself, would rather be away from the body and together with the Lord. He talks about this in 2 Corinthians, and that indicates he's envisioning his soul leaving his body, so it's away from the body, but being present with the Lord. And we also see in Revelation the souls of the martyrs in heaven in more than one passage. We see them both coming up out of the great tribulation on earth. We also see some of the martyrs under the altar in heaven talking to God. They're clearly having conscious experiences. And so the Bible clearly has the idea that the soul survives death, and frankly, it also, as I covered, has the idea that the soul is immortal. In the sense of being everlasting.
All right, Brennan.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was Mark verse 48, Mark chapter 9, verse 48 was the scriptural reference I was talking to with the logic problem, not the Revelation, just to clarify. But thank you very much for that.
All right, Brennan. Thank you. Thanks very much. Jimmy Akins, our guest, Ask Me Anything is our topic, which means you bring the topic. If you got something you'd like to ask Jimmy about, I'll tell you what, right now, two lines open. You are welcome to seize them. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. You're very welcome if you're not Catholic. We love talking about all these issues, and we'll talk about them with anybody. So please do feel welcome. If you're new to the program, you're welcome too. Anybody's welcome. Am I making that point clear? Right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today.
Your heart and the season you're going through is where we want to encourage you and invite you to be a member of the Take-Two family.
And join us on Take-Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
A little bit of groovy music for you there. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything, and you really can ask anything when Jimmy here is here. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884, but lines filled up again. So back to the phones we go. Nate's in Connecticut listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Several people today calling from the app. You can just push a button and call. It's a great app to have. Thanks for downloading it. Nate, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I felt like you would be a good person to ask this question. So, the teaching of the Catholic Church is that death entered the world through sin, and the original sin was committed by humans. But we know that animal death occurred on Earth before humans existed, and therefore before original sin. For example, all the dinosaurs died before humanity began to exist. So how do we reconcile these two facts as Catholics while not rejecting science but still adhering to orthodoxy?
Well, I would propose St. Thomas Aquinas' solution, which in essence is that it has two parts. The first part is you need to understand the New Testament text about death entering the world through sin correctly. One of the things that is true of almost any statement a human makes is that it's made within a certain universe of discourse. The universe of discourse is the set of things that that the person has in mind when they're making a statement. And what Paul has in mind when he says death entered the world through sin, he's talking about humans. He's not talking about all creatures. He's just talking about humans. Human death entered the world through sin. And that's what we see in Genesis, which would have informed Paul's thinking. Genesis portrays Adam and Eve not as intrinsically immortal, but as being able to remain alive if they eat from the tree of life. So as long as they lived in Eden, they had access to the tree of life, and they could continue to eat from it, and they would continue to remain alive. But then, when they ate from the forbidden fruit, God kicked them out of Eden so that they would no longer have access to the tree of life, and they would therefore die. Okay. Human death thus entered the world through sin. But it doesn't say anything here about animals. Not all of the animals were meant to live in the Garden of Eden. Not all of the animals would have access to the tree of life. And God also made some animals carnivores. So this isn't telling us anything about animals. And St. Thomas Aquinas, in this regard, would say, number one, any natural system is going to break down or run down over time. It's going to corrupt, to use Aquinas's words, unless it's supported by grace. So that's what happened with Adam and Eve. If they hadn't been eaten from the tree of life and getting new grace, then their bodies would have ultimately run down and broken down over time, and they would have died, which is what happened after they lost access to the tree of life. They were no longer being supported by divine grace to keep them alive, and so their bodies eventually broke down and they died. But the access to the tree of life was a gift to humanity, not a gift to all creatures. And the second thing Aquinas would say, and did say, is that the natures of the animals didn't change with the fall. Lions were still obligate carnivores before the fall, so they ate other creatures like, you know, gazelles or whatever. And so Christianity in Aquinas's day, which was in the 1200s and thus several centuries before the modern scientific revolution, already had an awareness that there was animal death before the fall. And we know, even if you take Genesis fully literally, which you really shouldn't, but even if you did, we see death in the first two chapters of Genesis, first three chapters of Genesis, already, because Adam and Eve are told they can eat fruit. Well, when you eat fruit, that fruit dies. You know, its metabolism that it had while it was part of the tree ceases. Your stomach acids tear it apart and process it to take its nutrients and make them part of your body. And so we see, even in Genesis, the death of plant matter, the death of fruits prior to the fall of man. So there are multiple reasons here, and I could go on, but there are multiple reasons here why we should understand the statement that death entered the world through sin as applying to human death, not animal or plant death.
All right, Nate?
Yeah, thank you. Actually, if you can, I have a follow-up question.
Go ahead, Nate.
So would you then consider animal death to not be a natural evil, given that it existed before the fall?
Would I consider animal death not to be a natural evil? No, death in any form is an evil. It's a physical evil in philosophical categories. But again, evil was not exclusively due to the human fall. For example, the devil already had moral evil before the human fall, and there were various forms of physical evil before the human fall, like the pain a gazelle feels when a lion eats it, or the death of the gazelle in order to sustain the life of the lion. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, God created his world in a state of journeying, and that involves, among other things, the appearance of some life forms and the disappearance of others, and it won't reach perfection until the end. So God chose to create his world on a journey towards the end, but things like death and other forms of physical evil remain part of it until we get to that end point.
And Nate, I will leave it there. Thank you very much for the call and for the question. Going to Michigan now. Marissa is in Michigan watching on YouTube. Marissa, I see you've waited a long time. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, certainly. So on the internet, I've been hearing about new potential Our Lady of Medjugorje apparitions from the summer of 2024. I don't know how valid those posts are, of course, but I was wondering if the church came out with any official statements about these events being supernatural or not. And the follow-up would be, if the church has not come out with the position, what is yours?
Okay, so I don't have a personal position on this, but I can tell you the history of what's happened with Medjugorje. The initial bishop looked into the apparitions being reported in his diocese, and he ruled that they couldn't be considered supernatural. His successor then looked into them as well, and he ruled the same thing. Then the Yugoslavian Bishops Conference looked into them, and they concluded the same thing. Then, during the tenure of Pope Benedict XVI, he appointed the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith to look into this question, and they appointed a commission to study them more closely. And the results of that commission have not yet been released. So the current, as things stand, position is negative towards this being supernatural. Now, the Vatican then, of just a few months ago in May, issued a new set of guidelines for evaluating apparitions, and it has seven categories, with supernatural at the top, not supernatural at the bottom, and then a spectrum of other categories in between that reflect different degrees of confidence and problems that can pertain to an apparition. Thus far, they haven't made a ruling on Medjugorje. They probably will do so, because they've really been cranking. They've like already ruled on six different apparitions. And obviously, people who want to know about Medjugorje are a large number. And frankly, it looks like the new categories were designed to fit Medjugorje. In particular, one of the middle categories that is like, okay, we're not saying this is supernatural and there are significant problems here, looks like it was really specifically designed for Medjugorje. Having said that, Cardinal Fernandez, the head of the Doctrine Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, was asked about Medjugorje, and he said he hadn't yet had a chance to review the report, but they could look at it, and I think he said would be looking at it in terms of the new guidelines, and he didn't commit to which category they were going to put it in. The highest category that doesn't involve the Pope now is the second category. Under supernatural, there's a category called nihil obstat, which means we're not saying it's supernatural, but nothing obstructs. That's what nihil obstat means. Nothing obstructs the faithful from being able to participate in this in a healthy way. And he, when he was asked about Medjugorje, he mentioned, you know, that it could go in a number of different categories. And he even mentioned the possibility of a nihil obstat, provided that certain clarifications could be issued to clarify otherwise problematic statements. And this is something you see them doing in the recent approvals they've given, where they'll say, okay, we're giving a nihil obstat to this, but you need to understand it in this way to avoid some theological errors. And so he held up the hypothetical possibility that a nihil obstat could be given to Medjugorje, but he didn't commit to that. He said, I haven't looked at the documents yet. I haven't studied it yet. So this was all speculation. And frankly, some of the other lower categories seem to fit Medjugorje better. I suspect, because of how quickly they've been cranking through these things, that we will get a ruling on Medjugorje before too long. I suspect it won't be immediate because of the care they need to take in this case. And if I made a prediction, I would predict that they probably won't give it a nihil obstat, given some of the factors that are involved. But we'll have to wait and see.
And you brought us right to the break. Thank you for the question. I hope that answer was helpful to you, Marissa. Thanks for waiting. We will be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It feels to me like Jimmy has answered about a million questions today, but are we less than a million? It feels like a lot. And lots of folks still on the line, so no rest for the weary. Is that the expression, or is it nowhere? Some people say no rest for the wicked. Does anybody know the expression?
Well,
no.
I try not to be wicked, so.
I know, I've noticed
weary
that.
Weary is, yeah.
All right, so no rest for the weary today. Let's see. James in Virginia is next, watching on YouTube. James, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
So my question is about the church saying that there's no salvation outside the church. Mm-hmm. And this was clarified in, I think, Vatican II, that you can be saved outside the church if you have invincible ignorance. Mm-hmm. And my question is, if before that belief was clarified, say, 1,000 years ago, and someone believed what the church has clarified now, but there were still people who were teaching that you have to be objectively present or as a member of the church, could they still have been in good standing, or would there be some kind of disobedience involved in that?
By disobedience, are you asking would they have been lost, or are you asking would they have been disobeying what the church said they should do?
The latter, not completely lost, but in some kind of opposition to the church.
Okay, well, so I guess there's a couple things we need to pull apart here. The first one is the change of understanding that you refer to was not new. At Vatican II, there had the idea that a person could be saved if they had invincible ignorance of the truth of the Catholic understanding of the Christian faith. That was something that's been around for a long time, and there has been a greater realization of the implications of that. But that's been around for a long time, several centuries, in fact. Now, when it comes to, we kind of need to pull apart the issue of obedience to the church and salvation, because even today, the Catholic Church says people need to become Catholic. This is the, you know, fullness of the Christian faith, and Jesus wants people to have the fullness of what he provided for them. So if someone is innocently ignorant of that and they don't become Catholic, well, they're still objectively not doing what they should do. So there is a disobedience now, and that would have been true all the way back through the past, you know, back to the first century. So the issue of are they disobeying something is not affected by the church's understanding of this issue, it's something that that they'd be disobedient in any age for not becoming Catholic. The question is, how responsible are they for that decision before God? And that leads us to the second question, which is about their salvation. Well, okay, what's changed is not what actually saves a person. What's changed is the church's, the degree of precision with which the church understands the exceptions to the need to be part of the Catholic Church. And so this is analogous to how scientists now understand the law of gravity better than they did prior to Isaac Newton. And so, you know, the law of gravity still operated prior to Isaac Newton. And so, you know, even though they didn't understand it as well prior to Newton, gravity still functioned. But with time, we got a better understanding of gravity. But that doesn't have any retroactive effect on what happened before Newton. Gravity was still gravity. In the same way, salvation before the Second Vatican Council or any other point you want to name has always worked the same way, at least in the Christian age. And so what has happened is we have a better understanding of how salvation works today, but that has no retroactive effect on the salvation of people prior to the current level of understanding. Salvation has always been salvation, the same way gravity has always been gravity. It's just a question of how well do you understand and articulate these phenomena.
Okay, that wasn't quite what I was asking, but that is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
What I was wondering is, if there was someone who's already Catholic, and they mm-hmm. were teaching that you can actually be saved with invincible ignorance, but there was a lot of leaders mm-hmm. of the church who were saying, no, you cannot be saved, you have to objectively be enrolled in the church, would there be disobedience on the part of that Catholic who was saying that you can be saved in the invincible ignorance case?
Well, if we're talking about an age where the magisterium has said they're, you know, as I'll put it this way, has articulated a narrow understanding of the exceptions, and you know that, and you publicly proclaim a different position that's broader, then yeah, you would be disobeying what the magisterium's current position is. That wouldn't mean you were wrong. It would mean you were disobeying, and you could potentially have consequences from that in terms of, you know, that could legally be applied to you in terms of canon law. Having said that, this is an issue that has been complex down through history. If you look early in church history, you do not have a super restrictive position on who can be saved. There were authors in the second century, like Justin Martyr, who talked about some of the Greek philosophers who reasoned their way to God being saved because they sought to live according to logos, according to the divine reason, or Jesus, in without knowing it. You had a variety of early church fathers who were universalists. Eventually, you got a more restrictive consensus that developed, but even then, it wasn't a complete consensus because it wasn't an exceptionalist consensus because it was always recognized that catechumens can be saved. You know, Augustine talks about that, for example. And so catechumens are people who intend to become Christian and intend to become Catholic. They just haven't gotten there yet at the time they die. And Augustine, and this was the majority position, said, yeah, they can be saved. The Council of Trent in the 1500s took the same position. And then it was eventually realized no later than, in terms of official church teaching, it was recognized no later than the 1800s that someone in a state of invincible ignorance could be saved. So it's not like there's been a complete and utter shift on this. There's been ups and downs in the development of this throughout history, but it has never been an exceptionalist requirement in the church's understanding.
And we will leave that there. On we go. Thank you for the question. Andrew in Tennessee, listening on St. Rose Radio. Andrew, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy Akin. So my question for you Yeah, hello. So my question is basically, when the Pope does an action, is he thereby immediately saying to the entire Catholic Church, this is good, do this? And I specifically ask this in the context of when Pope St. John Paul II kissed the Quran, and when he received the mark of Shiva, and when he incensed Buddha and did all those other sorts of things.
Okay, so let's answer the general question first. When a pope does something, no, he is not saying that this is good and everyone should do it. In the first place, popes are aware of their own sinfulness, and they can be aware of it when they're committing a sin. You know, Pope Francis, for example, has acknowledged, I'm a sinner, I need people to pray for me, and the same is true of every pope. So popes are always, even if they're not aware that something they're doing is sinful, they certainly would not say, when I do something sinful, whether I'm aware of it or not, that everyone should imitate it. Secondly, they don't, when they do something, they recognize that they are in a different position than other people. So, for example, in the Kiss in the Quran incident, which did happen, the Pope recognized himself as a world religious leader at a diplomatic meeting trying to communicate a message to Muslims of respect. And this was how he chose to do that. That doesn't mean that every Christian needs to go buy a copy of the Quran and kiss it. This is a special diplomatic, in his view, this would be a special move for this moment by him, not a move for everybody. I think he was mistaken in that. I think this was a mistake. Now, you then mentioned a couple of other things. The Pope incensing Buddha, that never happened. You also mentioned the Pope taking the mark of Shiva, that never happened. The photograph that you see that is misrepresented of the Pope, quote-unquote, receiving the mark of Shiva is not that. It's of a picture of a Catholic Indian woman performing a greeting custom for dignitaries known as arti, that involves putting a mark on the forehead of the dignitary. So this woman who is Catholic is performing a greeting custom for dignitaries that does not involve the mark of the Hindu god Shiva. That is not what this is about. So I'd have to say it sounds like you have tapped into some sources of unreliable information. And if they're representing John Paul II as doing things like receiving the mark of Shiva or incensing Buddha, then I would find better sources, because those are misleading you.
Thanks. I'm going to see if I can get another question on. Andy in North Carolina, I'm leaving you very little time. So if you ask your question, we'll get you an answer. But if not, we won't get you an answer. Andy?
Okay. I was just wondering. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Yeah. What's your question?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The Masons are forbidden by the Dicastery and all the different documents. And I was just wondering if there's a reason why, like, Alcoholics Anonymous might not be, for the same reason. I know that there says it's irrevocable differences.
Okay. Thanks. So Alcoholics Anonymous actually is an organization with Catholic roots. And it's always been friendly and positive towards Catholics. The same thing is not true of Freemasonry. In many areas of the world, Freemasonry has been actively hostile towards the Catholic Church and has plotted against the Church in various contexts, not in all contexts, but in a number of them. And in addition to those problematic relationships, Masons teach religious indifferentism, the idea that it doesn't really matter what religion you are as long as you believe in the grand architect of the universe, you know, which is their conceptualization of God. Religious indifferentism, though, is false. Alcoholics Anonymous does not teach religious indifferentism. It says all of its members need to believe in some higher power, but it doesn't say it doesn't matter who you believe in. Or how you worship them. They just don't go into that question. They leave it up to you, but they don't say all religions are equal. In addition, Freemasonry has religious rituals And Alcoholics Anonymous, other than general entrustment to a higher power, really doesn't have complex religious rituals the way Freemasons do. And so they don't have any rituals that would conflict with the Catholic faith, whereas Freemasonry does.
Andy, I'm so grateful you got the question out quickly. I really do appreciate that. I'd love to give you a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. If you just hang on the line, Edgar will get an address and we will send that book out to you. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. He's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and a new episode drops tomorrow. Thank you, Jimmy. I really enjoyed the 2 hours.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett. Likewise.
And that'll do it for us. We'll see you again tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.